The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticize. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Good morning, and welcome to today's episode of Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Presents, originally recorded and broadcast on Thursday, September the 10th, 2026, at andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com. Today's episode is entitled The Films of David Cronenberg. The time is 8:17 over here in London, England, and it is nice to be presenting new content for you again. Okay, so what I'm going to do slightly differently today is I'm going to introduce this study with the personal life section of the David Cronenberg Wikipedia page, because he makes a very interesting couple of interesting statements in it that I think will be very useful to you when you hear about some of the films that we're going to get through today. So this is the personal life section. Cronenberg lives in Toronto. I'll add in, he is currently 83 years old. He was born on March the 15th, 1943. He is 83 years old. So we'll go back to personal life here. If I can get to it, I've gone too far. Here we are. Cronenberg lives in Toronto. He married his first wife, Margaret Hinson, in 1972. Their seven-year marriage ended in 1979 amidst personal and professional differences. They had one daughter, Cassandra Cronenberg. His second wife was film editor Carolyn Zeifman, to whom he was married from 1979 until her death in 2017. The couple met on the set of Rabid while she was working as a production assistant. They have two children, Caitlin and Brandon. In the book Cronenberg on Cronenberg, originally published in 1992, he revealed that The Brood was inspired by events that occurred during the unravelling of his first marriage, which caused both Cronenberg and his daughter Cassandra a great deal of turmoil. The character Nola Carveth, mother of The Brood, is based on Cassandra's mother. Cronenberg said that he found the shooting of the climatic scene in which Nola was strangled by her husband to be very satisfying. In a September 2013 interview, Cronenberg revealed that film director Martin Scorsese admitted to him that he was intrigued by Cronenberg's early work, but was subsequently terrified to meet him in person. Cronenberg responded to Scorsese, "You're the guy who made Taxi Driver and you're afraid to meet me?" In the same interview, Cronenberg identified as an atheist. "Any time I've tried to imagine squeezing myself into the box of any particular religion, I find it claustrophobic and oppressive," Cronenberg elaborated. "I think atheism is an acceptance of what is real." In the same interview, Cronenberg revealed that it depends on the time of day as to whether he is afraid of death. He further stated that he is not concerned about posthumous representations of his film work. "It wouldn't disturb me to think that my work would just sink beneath the waves without trace, and that would be it. So what? It doesn't bother me." In Cronenberg on Cronenberg, the director further elaborated that he was raised in a secular Jewish home, and while he and his family had no disdain towards any religion, such matters were not discussed. In the same book, Cronenberg said that in his teens he went through a phase where he wondered about the existence of God, but ultimately came to the conclusion that the God concept was developed to cope with the fear of death. In a 2007 interview, Cronenberg explained the role atheism plays in his work. He stated, "I'm interested in saying, let us discuss the existential question. We are all going to die. That is the end of all consciousness. There is no afterlife. There is no God. Now what do we do? That's the point where it starts getting interesting to me." In Cronenberg's later films, for example, A History of Violence, Eastern Promises, and A Dangerous Method, openly religious characters became more common. During an interview for A History of Violence, Cronenberg even chose to identify as a materialist rather than an atheist, stating, "I'm not an atheist, but for me to turn away from any aspect of the human body to me is a philosophical betrayal. And there's a lot of art and religion whose whole purpose is to turn away from the human body. I feel in my art that my mandate is not to do that." Cronenberg has spoken against right-wing politics, especially in the United States, on multiple occasions, saying in 2022 that, "I think the US has gone completely bananas, and I can't believe what the elected officials are saying, not just about Roe versus Wade, so it is strange times." In a separate 2022 interview, he claimed that US President Donald Trump didn't deserve to be addressed in his art. He also emphasized the importance of vaccines and called the notion of refusing a vaccine ridiculous. Cronenberg has stated that he views all art, including his own films, as inherently political, regardless of a creator's intentions. Now, that is the line that yesterday, I knew that this was going to be the next film, next study in the series, in the films of. I knew I was going to do David Cronenberg next. I didn't know when. It was only until yesterday afternoon that I knew I'd be free this morning and I'd be doing it this morning. And ever since that line, Cronenberg has stated that he views all art, including his own films, as inherently political, regardless of a creator's intentions. That stayed with me, and it's made me think about his films with regard to that statement. Now, before I start going through the films, there is a lot of very dark material in Cronenberg films. You can say, well, he's done something on John Carpenter, he was a horror director. Well, yeah, he'll do things about monsters and stuff like this, but these films get a little bit more uncomfortable. I'll give you an example. The fourth film I'm going to get to shortly, Crimes of the Future, it has a section that talks about the rape of a child. Okay, so the reason I mention that now is if this is material that you do not wish to hear, then I suggest that you tune out now. But what we're going to do is go over to his filmography, which is directly below the personal life section. And it starts off with 1969 Stereo. But actually, there are two films before that. So what we're going to do is the first film that he did, and these are all Wikipedia pages, and I'm just going to read from the Wikipedia page because I saw each of these. I scanned through most of it, to be quite honest with you. It's not for me. But there is a Blu-ray called David Cronenberg's Early Works, and it includes his first four films. So that is Transfer, From the Drain, Stereo, and Crimes of the Future. I would not recommend getting it because all of these films are on YouTube. Okay, so I was able to look at all these films on YouTube and I had to sort of scan through. And it was then that I discovered that if you want to scan through on YouTube for more than 2x speed, you have to become a subscriber and pay them money, which I'm not prepared to do. So anyway, Transfer is only 7 minutes long. It was released in 1966, and the plot, according to Wikipedia, is as follows. A psychiatrist and his patient at a table set for dinner in the middle of a field covered in snow. The psychiatrist has been followed by his obsessive former patient. The only relationship the patient has had which has meant anything to him has been with the psychiatrist. The patient complains that he has invented things to amuse and occasionally worry the psychiatrist, but that he has remained unappreciative of his efforts. Now, one thing I noticed on this page is under the reception, it says the Globe and Mail criticised the film as a pathetic effort that was horribly acted and scarcely directed. It also accused Cronenberg of stealing the idea from a Nichols and May sketch. And Nichols and May were apparently an American improvisational comedy duo act developed by Mike Nichols and Elaine May, who had three comedy albums which reached the Billboard Top 40 between 1959 and 1962. I'd never heard of them, but I thought I'd throw that in for you. Okay, so let's go over to the next film, which is From the Drain, it's called, and this was released in 1967. The plot summary here from Wikipedia is the film is centred on two men in a bathtub. It is implied that they are veterans of some past conflict, but revealed that they are currently in a mental institution. The first man is paranoid about the drain of the tub, the second indifferent to it. After the conversation between the two men progresses, a vine-like tendril emerges from the drain to strangle the first man. The second shows no emotion to this sudden turn of events, and the film ends. This is only a 14-minute film. And so now we go on to the next film, which is what starts off the David Cronenberg filmography section on his Wikipedia page, and that is Stereo, that was released in 1969. Okay, now the Stereo and Crimes of the Future, the film that we're going to get into after this, not to be confused with his penultimate film at the moment, I don't know if he's going to direct any more, Crimes of the Future from 2022, he chose to use that title again as a film we're going to get into after this one. But Stereo and Crimes of the Future are narrated, and you see action going on, but you don't hear the actor speaking, and apparently it's due to the fact that he used an Ariflex 35 camera to shoot these films, and you can't record voice at the same time with it because it makes a hell of a lot of noise, apparently. So that is the reason I understand that it was narrated, as was the film coming up. The other interesting thing for me is Cronenberg, to my knowledge, the only film I can think of that doesn't have a sex scene in it is The Brood. And he's also described The Brood as the only film he made without humour. He regards there to be humour in all his other films. So the plot to Stereo, released in 1969, according to the Wikipedia page, is as follows. The film purports to be part of a mosaic of educational resources by the Canadian Academy of Erotic Inquiry. It documents an experiment by the unseen Dr. Luther Stringfellow. A young man in a black cloak is seen arriving at the academy, where he joins a group of young volunteers who are being endowed with telepathic abilities, which they are encouraged to develop through sexual exploration. It is hoped that telepathic groups bonded in polymorphous sexual relationships will form a socially stabilizing replacement for the obsolescent family unit. One girl develops a secondary personality in order to cope with her new state of consciousness, which gradually ousts her original personality. As the volunteers' abilities develop, the experimenters find themselves increasingly unable to control the progress of the experiment. They decide to separate the telepaths, which results in two suicides. The final sequence shows the young woman who developed an extra personality wearing the black cloak. This is a 65-minute film. Let's move on to the next one, which has the problematic scene with a child in that I talked about. Okay, this is Crimes of the Future, and it was released in 1970. It also used the Arriflex 35 and was narrated, like I said. It was shot without synchronised sound due to the noise of the camera. Plot of Crimes of the Future. Set in 1997, the film follows Adrian Tripod, an occasional director of the House of Skin, a dermatological clinic. He embarks on a quest to find his mentor, the insane dermatologist Antoine Rouge. Rouge has vanished after a devastating plague caused by cosmetic products, wiped out all sexually mature women. Allegedly, the virus mutated, now affecting men and claiming Rouge's life. Tripod joins a succession of organisations, including Metaphysical Import Export and the Oceanic Podiatry Group, and meets various individuals and groups of men trying to adjust themselves to a defeminised world. When a House of Skin patient that Tripod had grown close to dies from the plague, Tripod checks into a mental health clinic and engages in foot fetishism. Tripod aligns with a group of paedophiles who kidnap a 5-year-old girl who has been exposed to chemicals intended to force her into puberty in order to impregnate her. However, one of the group is ultimately unable to bring himself to rape the young girl and leaves her untouched. Tripod enters the room where the girl is kept and sees the girl emit a cream-like white foam from her mouth. This brings him to the realization that, by artificially inducing puberty in the young child, she has become infected with the plague. Okay, so originally I was just going to start my series on the films of David Cronenberg with his first official financed release, because these were arguably, these four films I've run through were just student films. I then read about them and knew that I'd have absolutely no desire to buy this at all. I wouldn't want it in my collection. And then I discovered that they were on YouTube, so I thought, look, just have a quick flick through. You can see, you know, see what's going on and what have you. And that's what I did. But I wouldn't want to pay for any of what I've just read. So 1975 is his first proper film that had financing and what have you, was commercially released, that sort of thing. It's called Shivers. Now, it had a variety of different names. I think it was also called They Came From Within. And essentially, what happens here, I'm going to go off my own memory now rather than the, because I actually watched these films properly start to finish. So, you've got some sort of things that look like slugs. They're sort of slimy, horrible-looking things. Do they come from the human body? Do they come from outer space? Difficult to know. But what basically happens is they start infecting people and they can pass from one person to another. But what they do is they end up, the way that they infect people is that they turn people into, how can I put it, sexually overactive people. So people infect each other by, you know, sexually molesting them, basically. It's a really quite an odd concept. But again, this is what you find sex quite predominant in all of Cronenberg's films. So that is essentially what goes on in this film. More and more people get infected. It's set in Canada, and that's basically it. It just develops from there, and it's a sort of like a zombie-type film in that sense with all the different people getting infected. It's 87 minutes, so it's your standard film. Now, what happened as a result of this, which is quite interesting, is Cronenberg was renting an apartment at the time in Canada, and there was a clause in his department, in his apartment, regarding morality. And when the... there was someone, I think, a reviewer or something, that made a, was really, really upset about this film. And also the fact that it was financed by a Canadian Film Council. And he got into the news media, what have you, about it, saying how dreadful it was. And his landlord heard about it, Cronenberg's landlord, and he was subsequently evicted from his apartment because by releasing that film, they claim that he broke their morality clause. So that is an interesting side story from this film. And then we move on to 1997, which is the film rabid or rabid. I don't know whether you pronounce it. It's obviously, if you are rabid, it's what happens when you have caught rabies. So we'll call it rabid. But in rabid, it starts off with a woman involved in an accident, a woman and husband or boyfriend, I forget if they're married. They're on a motorbike, they have an accident. He's pretty much okay, but she's quite badly injured. And she's taken to a hospital that does this new form of plastic surgery. And rather than using the people's skin, they use something that's man-made. Substance to replace the skin, but apparently you wouldn't know, and you don't with this woman. The interesting thing is, the woman that he cast for the role was Marilyn Chambers, who at the time had only appeared in pornographic films, and she was very famous for the pornographic films in which she appeared, and was reasonable to hire as well. So the purpose of hiring her was that he would have a known name for the film, and also someone that would be prepared to do the nude scenes that were required for the film. And to date, I understand this is the only non-pornographic role that Marilyn Chambers ever undertook. But what happens is she has these operations to repair her skin from the damage she got in the motorcycle accident. And she develops an orifice under one of her arms that ends up feeding on human blood. Delightful, isn't it? So what happens then is she seduces different men. And then once this feeds on them, it doesn't kill them, but it makes them contract rabies. And then, of course, they go after each other. So it's quite similar in a lot of ways to the previous film, Shivers. But again, one thing that I did notice about both Rabid and Shivers is it's got that look of a 70s horror film, that washed out type of that washed out picture. It looks like it's drained of a lot of its color. It's not got the striking colors that you would see in recent films. So that's something that I noticed about that film. And it's just like, as I say, a zombie type of film. And again, let's move on to The Brood that we referenced already. Cronenberg said it was influenced by the breakup of his marriage. Well, actually, we won't, because before that, there is a film called Fast Company. Now, Fast Company is a commercial film. Cronenberg admits he just directed it for the money. And it's about dragster racing. And you can find this on YouTube as well. So I watched it on YouTube. I was quite amused because this really is, probably because there is some nudity in it, I suppose it would be a 15 here in the UK. Different countries have different ways of classifying their films. But it's about a team that does dragster racing and they go from place to place. John Saxon actually is the only actor that I recognise. He appears as the team manager, corrupt team manager, and it's what goes on as they go from place to place and their internal struggles in the team and how they race against other teams and things like that. It's an interesting story, and it's not a bad film, but I found it quite amusing that on YouTube, where you've got nude scenes, they've got some sort of blurring over any of the nudity, but not in the blurring way I've seen. It's almost like someone held like a magnifying glass, because it's round, over the bit where you could see the nudity. And I was quite pleased for that, quite honestly, because I don't watch films for nudity or sex. I find that quite off-putting, and so that was obscured. But the story itself, it's worth a watch, I suppose. It's not something I would go back to again, and it's not something that I plan to buy, because it is available, funnily enough. The DVD comes with Stereo and Crimes of the Future on it as well, so presumably it's a double disc set, but this was £20-30, I think, and you have to get it from America, so it's not something that appealed to me. But it was good to find it on YouTube. That takes us on to 1979's The Brood. So what happens here is you have a woman who's checked into a clinic that's run by Oliver Reed, and she's undertaking some sort of psychiatric work because she's had some problems, psychiatric problems. And the psychiatric work that he's undergoing is experimental, and it's controversial as well. And for some reason, this psychiatric work that she's doing ends up creating these... they're little people, okay? They're not quite children. When you do see them, they've got very frightening, ugly faces, and they go round attacking people, and they're what's called the Brood. And it's directed... Sorry, it stars Oliver Reed, who, of course, many people will be aware of, Samantha Eggar and Art Hindle. So he's got more of a sort of well-known cast here. And I found it quite a struggle to get through, even though it's only 92 minutes. But not a lot seems to happen. The first half an hour, it's just, you know, the husband of the woman who's in the hospital, the psychiatric hospital, and it's just him sort of going through his life and stuff like that, and not a great deal seems to be going on. And then when you do see these little horrible demonic looking creatures running about, they're in very few and far between, although I noticed that my copy was a few minutes shorter, so it may have been cut. Not that I'd be looking for these sort of scenes, because the stupid thing is, for someone who's reviewing arguably a director best known for horror films, when I see things like that on screen, I tend to... I'm one of the people that would hide behind the couch. In this case, I don't have a couch to hide behind, so I put my look away or put my hand over my eyes, that sort of thing. I just find that horror films tend to have more interesting stories than, say, a lot of dramas, things like that, and I guess that's why I look at some of them. And the reason that I've gone down the line and looked at films like I've just gone through, you know, starting with Shivers by David Cronenberg, is I got so tired of picking up a direct-to-video horror film secondhand that I'd not heard of, putting it on and finding it to be absolute garbage. I thought, look, if you just go with a known director who's, you know, goes to Cannes every time he's got a film out, he's invited to the Cannes Film Festival, stuff like that, so he is regarded, rather than these films that tell you how wonderful they are on the cover, and then you find out if they even have a Wikipedia page, and a lot of them don't, because they're that amateur and low budget, they don't even warrant their own Wikipedia page. If they do have one, they're direct to video, they've been absolutely panned, stuff like that. And I was sick of wasting my time on things like that, so I thought I'll look through the films of a director such as Cronenberg. Okay, so there's The Brood, and now I'm going to get into a little bit more detail, because what's coming up is what we've got now is Scanners from 1981. Now, this is another film I saw recently. It stars Michael Ironside is the lead role. He's an actor that pops up in a lot of things. Good actor. And what it's about is there's some people in the world called scanners. And they can essentially... they've got telepathic and telekinetic powers. And you've got a company that's trying to get hold of all these scanners. I mean, let's read the video cover, or the film poster, whatever you want to call it. There are 4 billion people on Earth. Oh, this was filmed long ago, wasn't it? 237 are scanners. They have the most terrifying powers ever created, and they are winning. So what happens is, when one of these people comes after you, is they can cause your head to explode. Okay, so it's quite a bizarre story. And you have a situation here where you've got a company that's trying to recruit these scanners to do with them what they want. And you've got a scanner that they did recruit called Revok, who is the lead character, if you like, played by Michael Ironside. And he is trying to recruit all the scanners as well to join him. And so you've got one group of scanners hunting the other and harming each other and things like that. It's an interesting premise, and that's really the best way to sum up that film. Okay, so let's move on to the film that followed that, Videodrome. Now, Videodrome it stars James Woods and Deborah Harry, or Debbie Harry from Blondie. And it's an interesting film. But it's interesting more for its premise than, for me, its execution. So you've got a guy, James Woods, in Canada. It's set in Toronto in the early 1980s. And he's got, excuse me, his own television station. And he finds a broadcast going out from somewhere that's broadcast all these short films involving torture and things like that, horrible little things. And he wants to get hold of them because he knows that he can use them for his station. And he's being interviewed about it at some point, what he's trying to do. And they say, why are you going for stuff like that? He says, well, we're a small station. We don't have much money. And, you know, it's getting hold of stuff like this is going to give us a greater market share, things like that. So he's completely motivated by money. But what happens is that he, when getting these things, it drives him into a hallucinatory state. And it gets to the stage where the videos and the video recorder appear to be living things. And in order to watch a video, he will place it inside his own chest. So there's some really odd scenes like that going on. I'm not really sure what the whole thing means. It's I think it was written as it was being, the script wasn't finished as it was being filmed, and it was written as they were filming it. So I've seen it. I don't know if I'll be going back to watch it again, to be quite honest with you. I found the extras on the Blu-ray. It's one of those things where when you, the Blu-ray is actually cheaper than any of the DVDs I could find out there. There's some extras on it that were quite interesting. I referred to in a previous show, a sit-down with, hosted by Mick Garris with David Cronenberg, John Landis and John Carpenter, where they're discussing their films. And it was recorded at the same time as Cronenberg was filming Videodrome and John Carpenter was filming The Thing. So it's a 1982 interview, goes on for about 20 minutes. And I found that to be more interesting, to be honest, than the film itself. And also on the extras, there is a guy who writes as Jack Martin, and he did the novelization for Videodrome, and he also did the novelizations for a couple of the Halloween films as well, which if you try and look for them online, they want about £60-70 for a pretty well thumbed paperback book, which I'm not prepared to pay. He talks about his books and the novelization of film process there, which I found interesting as well. Okay, so that takes us on to 1983, because Videodrome was 82, was released in 83. But this is the first of David Cronenberg's great films. It's called The Dead Zone. It stars Christopher Walken, and it's based on a Stephen King adaptation, a Stephen King book. And what happens is there's a guy, Christopher Walken. You see him at the start. He's obviously deeply in love. He's a teacher. He's deeply in love with a fellow teacher, and he's leaving her house, and he gets into a collision with a truck, and 5 years later he wakes up from that, and he discovers that he has an ability to see bad things happening in the future. He's got this ability. Also, he can see things, you know, in the past. For example, he has a doctor who believes his mother is dead, and he suddenly has a vision. And he says, your mother's not dead, she's still alive. And he tells her where she is. But he has all these different visions, and he's able to, in a lot of cases, warn people before they come to pass. And he's also struggling with the fact that he was, one of his last memories was saying goodbye to a woman he intended to marry. When he wakes up 5 years later, she's married with children. So but there's some interesting things in there. He's consulted to try and find a serial killer. So that's a story in its own. And then he is confronted by a vision involving a man who's running for Congress or Senate at the time. And he's seen as a bit of a joke. He's quite funny because he's one of these, he's a political populist at the time. We know what they say about them. And he has a vision that this guy not only gets elected, but one day becomes president and starts a nuclear war. And he's like, what am I going to do about that? And so the whole film is a really interesting story. For me, all the ones that we've gone through, I watched them simply because I knew I was going to be doing a presentation on them, and I just need to study something that I can actually talk about, which is more and more difficult in this day and age with censorship. So all these films being available on Amazon, and, you know, as I've talked about before, I thought I'd go through and get a little bit here. If I can watch something for free here on YouTube, I'll do that and what have you. But this is really, without things like The Dead Zone, I wouldn't have the interest in Cronenberg to start watching other films. But the first Cronenberg film I saw was when it came out. So it came out in 1986. I'd have seen it on video probably a year later. That would have made me 14 years old. It was The Fly. And it starred Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis. And it was a very good story. This is another one of his great films that I recommend people watch. It's very, very disgusting, some of the imagery that you see. I had a poster. I don't know about you, but I would go to video shops in my area, and if you asked them, they'd let you have their old posters when they took them down. And so they'd let you just take away what was there, and then you'd decide what you wanted, and they went up on the wall and things like that. Sometimes they'd be a bit torn and what have you, but they were still official posters. And I remember as a 14-year-old, what encouraged me to watch the film, I just knew it was called The Fly. It said, these quotes, "If you're planning on dinner and a movie, skip the former." And it was all this, it was apparently so disgusting what was going on. Where the disgust comes from is, again, an intriguing story. Now, it's based on a film, I think the 50s, The Fly or something like that, but if you look at the imagery from it, you've got a guy who's got a fly's head on. It looks more like a comedy than a horror film. It looks so ridiculous. But what happens in Cronenberg's remake of it is you have a scientist who has developed a teleportation machine. And they're called pods. And so he's got his big apartment stroke science lab, whatever. He lives and works in the same place. And he's got these two or three pods in there. And what he does, he can go into one pod and it will disintegrate him and reanimate him into another pod. And then he comes out and he's fine. Well, not quite, because he discovers that when he went into a pod, he starts to have these changes in his body. And at first they're good. He develops really superhuman strength. But then he starts to develop bad skin conditions, all these different things. His fingernails start falling off. Amongst other things, there's a scene where he opens his bathroom cabinet door and you see his penis inside the cabinet. So all different body parts have been dropping off. And he discovers that when he went through this teleportation process, a fly had got into the pod with him. And he types in, "What happened to the fly?" And it turns out, he said, "Did Brundle," because his name's Seth Brundle, "did Brundle absorb fly?" And the computer response says, "Negative." It says, "What happened to fly?" "Fusion." And so what happened was the teleportation process disintegrated both the Goldblum character and the fly and created a new being out of them. And gradually, the human part of that being starts dropping off, until at the end you've just got this fly, this huge man-sized fly. And it is very horrible to look at, very as a kid, you know, like something you've never seen before. And it's a horror film like you've never seen before. There was a sequel film that didn't involve Cronenberg that is worth watching. Excuse me. But you can actually get, I've got a double pack with them both in. And that's worth getting. I'm very quickly going to pause. Something I should have mentioned about The Dead Zone is, if you're going to get this on DVD, make sure you get the copy that has the Stephen Jones and Kim Newman audio commentary on it. It is excellent. I've listened to that audio commentary many, many times, and it's very well done. Always look out for Kim Newman, Stephen Jones commentary tracks, because they're very entertaining. They're both informative and humorous. Okay, so going back to The Fly, that's pretty much how it ends up. It's a horror film like no other, and it's something that had an effect on me when I was 14 years old that I first saw it, and it's one of Cronenberg's finest films. And we move on to the film that followed that, called Dead Ringers, that I saw when it came out on video as well, based upon seeing The Fly, and I didn't really like it at the time. But for me, it's become probably the greatest filmed acting performance I have ever seen. It's based on a true story. The title Dead Ringers, it was originally going to be called Twins, but at the same time, Arnold Schwarzenegger was working on a film that was going to be called Twins. Whatever you have to do to copyright the title had already been done by Cronenberg, and so the people making the Schwarzenegger film approached them and offered to buy the title. And he agreed to sell the title because they were offering so much money. He could put it into the production of the film and make a better film. But in Dead Ringers, you've got two doctors that work as gynecologists, and they're twins, okay? And funnily enough, Cronenberg says he approached lots of different Hollywood actors, real big names. I think Robert De Niro's name was amongst them. And they were interested, but only if they could be lawyers instead of gynecologists. They were very unsettled by the idea that they'd be playing gynecologists for some reason. But Jeremy Irons ultimately agreed to do the film. And he had to play both himself and his twin brother. So originally he started out and he thought, I'll have different dressing rooms for each character and things like that. And then he realised that wasn't really working, and he developed a sort of technique. But his acting, he's really at the peak of his acting here in this film. And the way he can play himself against himself, and he can play, you can see the differences between the two, the way he acts the two brothers. One is more dominant and the other one's a bit more clumsy. The more dominant one's more self-assured. The clumsy one's, he's a bit of a sort of more of a nervous disposition, things like that. And he does an astonishing acting job. And he even said in the commentary track for this film that Jeremy Irons did, that when he got the Best Actor Award for Reversal of Fortune back in 1990, I think it was released, so it's probably the 1991 ceremony, he regarded it as a career Oscar. And he even thanked David Cronenberg for casting him in Dead Ringers before he thanked Barbette Schroeder, the actual director of Reversal of Fortune, which he was getting the Best Actor Award for, in his acceptance speech. But these two doctors, they get involved with a woman. One of them becomes besotted by her. The other one just wants to use her and move on. And this causes it's the more nervous one that becomes besotted by the woman. He starts to go into some sort of emotional breakdown, which causes the other one to break down because he doesn't realise until then how much he relies on his brother. Their whole lives fall apart, and it's a very interesting, if harrowing, story. Okay, so let's move on to, as I say, these three in a row were excellent, and now, well, we move on to Naked Lunch, which is an adaptation of the William Burroughs book. It was released in 1991. I saw it again at the time. It's got all these what look like beetles in it that speak out of their back passages, shall we say. It's a bizarre film to look at. I really wasn't looking forward to seeing it again. I did see it again. And I believe it has a commentary track, which I'm going to listen to again. I'm probably going to listen to that. I don't plan on seeing the film again. The film is very odd. The book, The Naked Lunch, is very odd. Many people said it couldn't be filmed. Essentially, Peter Weller is the actor in the lead role. Of course, he did a great job as the original RoboCop. And he is the drug addict William Burroughs, and it kind of combines William Burroughs' life with the book The Naked Lunch. He famously shot his girlfriend at the time, tried to do a William Tell routine, shoot an apple off her head, ended up killing her, that sort of thing. And it's just a bizarre drug-addled tale. It's not as bad as Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas that I had to give up on after a while. But I did manage to sit through this, but I wouldn't recommend it for anyone unless they're trying to watch every David Cronenberg film as I was. That takes us on to 1993's M. Butterfly, which again, it's based on the opera Madame Butterfly, which is why I never saw it, because I'm not interested in opera. But this is never, from what I can understand, got a DVD release in the UK, but it is on YouTube, so I was able to watch this on YouTube. And Jeremy Irons is back in it, so you think, wow, Jeremy Irons back with David Cronenberg. Believe me, you are going to be disappointed. Probably the best scenes in it are Ian Richardson, most famous for playing Francis Urquhart in the original House of Cards, the one set in the UK, not the one set in the United States starring Kevin Spacey. He plays David Cronenberg's boss in the French embassy in China. And he plays an excellent role there. David Cronenberg becomes besotted with an actor. I think they like to call themselves actors now, male or female, don't they? In the opera Madame Butterfly. And it ends up resulting in the breakup of his marriage, and he loses his job, and he ends up doing menial work back in France, and Madame Butterfly comes over and he calls this person his butterfly. And it turns out that this person was a spy for the Chinese government. So when M. Butterfly arrives in France, subsequently arrested, as is Jeremy Irons, for giving information to the Chinese, and it's revealed that M. Butterfly is actually a little Chinese fella. Okay, and they go on trial, and Jeremy Irons goes to jail, and that's pretty much that. So not a film I will be watching again. That takes us on to 1996's Crash, which, before we blame Cronenberg for doing a story about people who gain sexual gratification over watching car crashes, this was actually written by a guy called J.G. Ballard, who after his death, the British government proudly announced that they paid, I think, £250,000 for all his papers to be held at the British Library. So they're obviously interested in material such as this. But anyway, going back to the film Crash, it stars... let me see. I think it's Rosanna Arquette and James Spader. Holly Hunter as well. Elias Koteas, who's always quite a good actor, who pops up in a variety of different roles. He tends to pop up in small roles. He popped up famously in The Sopranos in the intervention scene with the Christopher Moltisanti character. Did a very memorable role there. A couple, as I say, they discover that they're interested in car crashes. They get some sort of gratification out of them. I was working at the time this came out at an office in London. I remember my manager at the time saying, you know, how horrible it was, because it gained a big, created an uproar in the media in the UK, and many people were not going to screen it. I think Francis Ford Coppola, it was shown at Cannes, and Francis Ford Coppola had to do some sort of presentation on it, and I think he either refused to do the presentation because he was the chosen head of the Cannes. They invite different people on their judging panel. I think he was one of them, or the head one, or whatever, the year that was there, and he either showed a lot of disdain for the film or refused to do something. You'll be able to find out if you wish to look up its Wikipedia page. Well, I'm on it now. Let's see. Here it says, at the Cannes Film Festival, a screening provoked boos and angry bolts by upset viewers. In a 2020 interview, Cronenberg stated that he believed Francis Ford Coppola, the jury president at the 1996 Cannes Film Festival, was so vehemently opposed to Crash that other jury members in favour of the film banded together to present Cronenberg with a rare, special jury prize. So great was Coppola's distaste for the film that, according to Cronenberg, Coppola refused to personally present the award to the director. So there's the story, and I think that's pretty much it for Crash. Let's move on to the next one, which is Existence. Now, Existence, it stars Jennifer Jason Leigh and Jude Law, and they basically become trapped in a computer game. It's more science fiction than it is horror, although it's called science fiction and horror. It came out in 1999. I watched it, didn't get anything from it, found it quite boring, even though it is fairly short. Let me look at the length. It is 97 minutes, but it's not a film I plan to go back to. It has got a commentary track by Cronenberg, so I'm going to listen to it again, and I think I'll probably be something that I'll listen more to the commentary track than I will to the film. But just, well, let's see if they say anything more on the Wikipedia page. The film follows Allegra Geller, a game designer who becomes the target of assassins while playing a virtual reality game of her own creation. So yeah, she gets stuck in her own game. The X-Files did a similar, an episode such as this. I'm not sure if it came out before or after. I would say before, because I think it was in season 3 or 4. And yeah. You get artificial intelligence chasing them around, and they get locked in a computer game as well. So I forget the title of it. I should know it. I'll look it up quickly if I can. But as I say, the film itself is not one that I would really be going back to. It was followed by a more interesting film called Spider. Now, Spider, I'll just quickly give you the title of this X-Files episode. If I can, no, I can't see it there. I'm sorry, I can't seem to find it. So let's go over. Oh, Kill Switch. It was from season 5 of The X-Files. Kill Switch is the one where Mulder and Scully get locked in a game. Okay, let's start again what I was saying, because I was distracting myself as I wanted to give you that information. Following 1999's existence, 2002 brought the release of Spider, in which a man is set in London. A man goes back to, he's released from a mental institution. The lead character, who's played by Ralph Fiennes, and he goes back to the area where he was brought up, and he starts to get these flashbacks as to what happened in his life. And so you start seeing him as a boy, and his father's played by Gabriel Byrne, and you see what went on in his life to lead up to him being in the mental institution. And that's when you find out how he ended up there. And it's quite an interesting film. I must admit, while I was watching it, I got a little bit... It's a very slow film. It's only 98 minutes, but those do drag. But when you get to see the conclusion, it's quite an astonishing sort of conclusion how it all comes about. And I don't want to give too much away. There are certain films here that I might have done a little too much spoilers on. I do apologise if that's the case, but be assured, I've only done, when I talk more in depth about things like The Fly and things like The Dead Zone and Dead Ringers, I haven't given you all the information. The information you've got, you'll learn pretty soon as you start watching it, because there are bits in there that are very entertaining to watch. This is not one of my favourites, but it does have a very interesting ending if you can sit through the film before you get to that point. But anyway, let's move on to the film that followed that, which for me was a return to form for Cronenberg. It's 2005's The History of Violence. Now, this stars Viggo Mortensen. Basically, he's working in his own diner, little American town, and some people come in to try and rob the place. And he's very polite to them, you know, just please don't hurt anybody, stuff like that. And when it turns out that they're psychopaths, okay, and you see them doing something before, so you pretty much know what's going to come. They're not very nice people. He suddenly turns into some sort of Viggo Mortensen. He's able to take these two people out to an extent that's like, wow, how did he do that? And consequently, he gets people, news crews from around the country saying, you know, this guy's just, how did he take on these, he was unarmed, he took these two armed men on and defended the people in his cafe and his staff and all that, and he becomes something of a hero, and he just doesn't want to talk to anyone about it. As a result of that, a mysterious guy played by Ed Harris starts stalking Mortensen and his family, and subsequently reveals that Mortensen isn't quite who he claims to be. And I'm going to leave it there. But for me, this is, I'm going to say it's up there with The Dead Zone, The Fly and Dead Ringers. And it just goes to show how the last great film that I think he did was in 1988. He did another five films before I believe he did another great film. So this is why if you really want to know about a director, you kind of have to watch everything, unless there's something that, like John Carpenter's film about Elvis, that I'm not interested in Elvis at all, that you just know is not there. But I imagine if I did sit through it, there might still be some bits in there. And if I did see it for a pound in a shop, maybe even the fiver, I probably would buy it just to say I've seen them all. That takes us on to 2007's Eastern Promises, which again stars Viggo Mortensen, and it's set in London amongst the Russian mafia. And there are some horror bits in it. Viggo Mortensen plays a Russian mafia mobster. He's got all these tattoos on him. It's also got Naomi Watts, I believe, in there, playing another lead role. And she gets involved with Mortensen and the Russian mafia when she delivers a child and traces its father. I think the mother dies in childbirth, and she starts looking into, you know, who's the father? Let's find out who this family is, and then finds herself in this Russian mafia world. It's a very interesting tale. And there's a fight scene in it in a swimming bath towards the end. Well, I wouldn't call it swimming baths, more of like a sauna type thing. I don't really see a pool there. But it's regarded as one of the most brutal fight scenes that there is. And it is very well done, but I did have to look away. That takes us on to 2011's A Dangerous Method, which was a film that didn't really interest me. I picked it up for a couple of quid, fortunately. But what it's about is it's about the birth of psychoanalysis. And so it's about Sigmund Freud, it's about Carl Jung, it's about Sabina Spielrein, who was a female psychoanalyst that I hadn't heard of. And it is quite well acted. It has Viggo Mortensen in again, and Vincent Cassell, who was also a lead character in Eastern Promises alongside Mortensen. Michael Fassbender is in there as well, so he's got quite a few big names. And Keira Knightley stars as the Sabina Spielrein character. It's more of a drama to me. It's got sex in it, as would be expected from any Cronenberg film. But I actually found the story quite interesting. It's not something that I've ever looked at, and I'm not a fan of psychiatry, psychoanalysts, anything like that. But it was interesting to see how this came together and these characters. Because whether you agree with what they practiced or not, for example, Carl Jung, he was able to pursue his work because he was married to a woman who had a hell of a lot of money. So consequently, he could do pretty much what he wanted. If he wanted to, you know, spend his life researching butterflies or something, he could do, because he was a kept man, as they say. And in fact, it's based on a book by John Kerr called A Most Dangerous Method, The Story of Young Freud and Sabina Spielrein. So there you go. Let's move on to, we're getting close to the end here now. Excuse me, 2012's Cosmopolis. Now, this as a film, it stars Robert Pattinson. On the surface, it looks quite interesting, because the plot is, from Wikipedia, we'll go back to, because although I saw it, I was just counting the minutes very quickly. It was so boring. 28-year-old billionaire and currency speculator Eric Packer rides slowly across Manhattan amid traffic jams in his state-of-the-art luxury stretch limousine office to his preferred barber. Various visitors discuss the meaning of life and inconsequential trivia. Yes, I'd agree with that point. The traffic jams are caused by a visit of the President of the United States and the funeral of Eric's favourite musician, a rap artist whose music he plays in one of his two private elevators. Anyway, I'll leave it there. Basically, the whole film takes place with him in his car, he's in the barber's shop, but you've got like riots going on, and you see sort of people banging on his car and things like that. Apparently, there was the 2008, was it, the Wall Street protests and things like that. It was inspired by that. Of course, he has sex with a variety of women in his car, as one would expect from a Cronenberg film. And I just found it to be one of the most boring films I've ever seen. And this leads us on to the next film. We've only got three left. 2014's Maps to the Stars. And this has quite... You've got Robert Pattinson returning, and it stars Julianne Moore and John Cusack. And it's described as a satirical black comedy. But you've got a child actor who I think earns something like £300,000 a week or a month or something like that. Just ridiculous amount of money. And he's only 13. He's already been in rehab. His father is somebody who does some sort of bizarre psychoanalysis. So he's like a doctor of sorts. One of his clients is Julianne Moore. And it's all about what Hollywood people get up to. And it's quite disgusting what they do get up to and the way that they do act. For example, Julianne Moore, at one point, she's up for playing the role of a character. And she doesn't get the role, and she's absolutely devastated by it. And the person that gets the role, another woman, subsequently her son dies in a swimming pool accident, and she's so distraught she has to pull out the role, and then the role's offered to Julianne Moore, and she's celebrating, dancing around the fact that this other actress's, or should I say actor's son died, and now she's got the role. And this is really how the people are portrayed, and I would argue that, I wouldn't be surprised if this is how a lot of people in Hollywood really do act and do think. There's a delightful scene if you want to see Julianne Moore farting on the toilet. You get subjected to that. It's not a film I enjoyed or I would go back to, but it does show a revealing portrait of what goes on with both people who are established in Hollywood, and it also focuses on people who want to get into the Hollywood business, either via, you know, you've got an aspiring actor who's actually a chauffeur. People say that everyone in Los Angeles has got a resume or a reel, or they're all an aspiring actor of some sort or another. So that's that. And then we move on to Crimes of the Future. So this isn't a remake of the, what was that? Was that 1970? Yeah, 1970 film. It's got nothing to do with the 1970 film I covered. This is a return to a body horror. And what you've got is Viggo Mortensen's back in it. He looks a great deal older, but his last film was, what, 15 years before with Eastern Promises. He returns to a Cronenberg film. And he, along with his partner, involved in... How can I best put this? They do surgery on each other for public consumption. It involves cutting him open, removing organs, tattooing organs, replacing the organs back tattooed, this sort of thing. It's a bizarre story. But I felt with the tattooing that goes on today, I mean, Cronenberg is, I'm not into tattooing at all, but Cronenberg clearly is more hip than me, because I see people, virtually every visible part of their body I see regularly is tattooed. And so surely the next stage would be internal tattooing, which is what is one of the aspects of this film. I found it quite boring and I found it quite horrible to watch. I don't like any of these sort of medical things, even if they've got a, you know, there used to be a program on the television in the UK called Jimmy's, where it was filmed, people having operations, it was filmed in a hospital, and quite squeamish. I couldn't watch anything like that. So it takes us to the final film, 2024's The Shrouds. And I have gone on for quite a length of time, just over an hour, but there's a lot of films to get through. Now, this is a good film to end on, because, excuse me, despite all the other things that I've just managed to spill water all over my glasses when I just took a swig from that bottle, so I'm just cleaning those. I saw that film and I had to order these films new. It's weird, isn't it? Sometimes you go on to eBay and all the second-hand copies are actually more expensive than you can buy new. Well, that was the case here. I watched both of them earlier in the week, Crimes of the Future and now The Shrouds. Now, how do I describe this film? You've got a guy, obviously quite wealthy. He's played by Vincent Cassell, so he reappears, I think, in his first Cronenberg film since A Dangerous Method. And his wife has died. And the opening scene, he's on a blind date. Now, he's probably about 60. And he's on a blind date with a woman at his place of business. And the woman becomes visibly shocked when he tells her that what he does is he's invented this concept that he calls the shrouds. And what happens is that you get your loved one buried in one of these shrouds, and consequently they're able to be filmed as they are decomposing. Okay? Yeah, that's what I just said. And so to the extent that you can, at any time, you can pick up your phone, you can log on to the Shrouds app, it's called Grave Tech, and you can click on it, and you can just look at a live feed of the person you put in that grave, your loved one, of them decomposing in real time. And that's what happens is then that concept catches on. There are all sorts of people around the world who want to license grave tech and have their own grave tech cemetery in Hungary and all different countries around the world. And you get to see some of these images of people decomposing in their graves, which is rather unpleasant. And as I say, his cemetery is vandalised, so he then tries to look into who's vandalising the cemetery. Also in the film is Guy Pearce. And the actresses in there are Diane Kruger and Sandrine Holt. Not wishing to miss out on sex, as is so prevalent in Cronenberg's other films, you get treated to not just one, but two sex scenes involving what looks like the 60-year-old Vincent Cassell and a woman of similar age. And after seeing them, I have to say, I thought to myself, you know, can I just have a look at one of them graves again? Okay, so what I presented to you today is not the subject I'm best known for, but after having my God-given right to free speech stolen from me by the very people who are supposed to protect it, it has been a joy to be able to speak freely on this subject today. It is not until I did it that I realised how much I missed it. So don't enjoy the subject matter too much, but it's nice to be able to talk freely. Just very quickly, I'm going to just let you know that the next director in this series is going to be David Lynch. The reason I'm letting you know that is I've watched everything apart from Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. The latest I've heard is it's delayed in transit. That might mean it turns up today, it might mean it turns up in a week, or it never turns up at all. So I can't do that until I've got that film, and that is the one I want to do next. So until I get that, I won't be doing another one of the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Presents shows. So I apologise for any delay. It is out of my hands. Okay, so if you enjoyed this episode of Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Presents and have the financial wherewithal to do so, then please support the show by clicking the blue donate button at andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com. The more donations I get, the more shows you get. And in the meantime, thank you for listening, and bye for now.